This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ever since September 11th, we've really needed the help and cooperation of our European allies. But what do Europe's current leaders think of the Bush administration's plans to invade Iraq? My guest, Steve Erlanger, is the Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times. We invited him to talk with us about this and to discuss how life is changing abroad in the new era of the European Union and the euro. Erlanger has held many positions at the Times, including bureau chief for Central Europe and the Balkans, Moscow bureau chief, and chief diplomatic correspondent in Washington. As the European Union is getting stronger, the United States still remains the only superpower. Let's talk about how the United States is looking right now in Europe, more specifically how President Bush is looking right now in Europe. And let's begin with the United States' plan to invade Iraq. How much support does that have among European leaders?
Well, among Europeans as a population, it probably has little to no support, but no one's really going to ask them. Among European leaders, there's a kind of shrugging, almost a feeling that, you know, if this is something the United States desperately wants to do, the Europeans will have to find some way of going along with it. But they have problems with it, they have problems with the timing, they have serious questions about how it would work. They're worried about destabilization of the Middle East. And in large part, they think the central problem of the Middle East is the Israeli-Palestinian problem and the deterioration in relations there. They do not see Saddam Hussein as a backer of al-Qaeda or even as a major supporter of international terrorism. And they think the obsession with Iraq on the part of the Bush administration is probably a little theological, a little puzzling, a little troubling, but very difficult to stop.
Now, the Bush administration seems convinced that Iraq has a supply of biological weapons, chemical weapons, and that they're in the process of making nuclear weapons. What's your understanding of why the United States is so confident of this and that yet the European leaders seem unconcerned?
Well, I don't think the European leaders disagree with that intelligence assessment. I mean, the intelligence is kind of widely shared. Europeans, and I've talked to some of the intelligence people about this here, they do not believe Saddam Hussein is close to getting nuclear weapons, though he has been trying to make them, as we know, for quite a long time. They do believe he has some stocks of biological and chemical weapons, which, you know, bother everyone a great deal. The question becomes one of threat. As a Frenchman put to me, a French diplomat, you know, you Americans think it's safer to kill the crocodile. We tend to think it's better to drain the swamp. In other words, people are worried that an effort to overthrow Saddam by force could have lots of unintended consequences and involve the use of those very weapons on American and allied soldiers in the field, let alone against Israel. And they fear that it will lead to new attacks on allied troops by al-Qaeda and other angry Arab forces, and that it will do little to stabilize the state of Israel or help along the problems with turning the idea of a democratic and nonviolent Palestinian state into reality.
If the United States does, in fact, proceed with the plan to invade Iraq and try to overthrow Saddam Hussein, can the Bush administration expect to get any support from Europe, particularly troop support?
I think it can, yes. And the reason is, as we all remember, the unfinished business of the Iraq War. And by that, I don't really mean the existence of Saddam Hussein. I mean the fact that, you know, the UN resolutions that govern the end of that war are still valid, and Iraq is out of compliance with them. Iraq has not, for a very long time now, allowed UN inspectors into Iraq to search out and destroy these efforts at producing weapons of mass destruction. so that legally Iraq is in defiance of UN Security Council resolution. And many international lawyers would argue, not just in America, that, you know, the ceasefire resolution that ended that war has been breached, and hence the state of war continues. So the allies, you know, who are with the United States during the Gulf War, I think will, if the evidence is clear and if Saddam Hussein continues to reject sincere efforts to let inspectors go through his country and declare it free of weapons of mass destruction, the Europeans will have no choice but to go along, I think, with the United States. Certainly not without having long discussions with Washington, which are already going on, about what kind of campaign, how long it would last, what, and most important, you know, what happens in Iraq afterwards.
Steve Erlanger is my guest. He's the Berlin Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Let's look at the Middle East and how Europe and the Bush administration stand there. President Bush has basically said he doesn't think Arafat is a viable peace partner. What about the European leaders? How are they reacting to President Bush's position?
Once again, they're reacting with a large degree of understanding. I mean, in the sense that, you know, Yasser Arafat has annoyed a lot of people and a lot of, you know, Western leaders for a long time. And no one's had any real illusions, you know, that he's a Democrat fully in charge of all Palestinians. However, the Europeans more than the Americans seem to feel that he is the at least mostly elected representative of the Palestinian people, and he can't simply be discarded. The German foreign minister, Joschka Fischer, has produced a paper to allies, which is being looked at and worked on, which suggests an immediate naming of a prime minister for the Palestinian territories, basically pushing Yasser Arafat upstairs to a kind of ceremonial presidential post, but putting day-to-day control of Palestinian life in the hands of someone else, and also at some point naming a UN or international arbiter and monitor to push along and help guide the Palestinians toward more self-determination and less concentration on violence, and help them build the structure of a civil society that can then become a state at the end of negotiations with Israel. So there's an effort by the Europeans to kind of listen to Bush, to understand what he's saying, to go along with him, but they are troubled by Mr. Bush's last speech, because it seemed to reject Yasser Arafat without providing any alternative. It seemed to many as a way of not pushing forward on a Middle East settlement, a kind of excuse for doing nothing. I mean, setting conditions so high the Palestinians couldn't possibly reach them, while setting very few conditions on the Israelis themselves. But among leaders who, you know, believe the United States is an important ally, want to be on the side of the United States, there is a lot of effort being made, some of it with gritted teeth, to find a way to take these pronouncements of a Republican administration in Washington and turn them into policy that, you know, other parts of the world can also go along with.
Before September 11th, President Bush was, I believe, seen in Europe as moving very unilaterally on things, not, you know, alienating allies, just doing what's best for the United States without a lot of consideration for what other countries felt or needed. Then after September 11th, there was this tremendous reaching out to other countries, trying to turn them into allies in the war on terrorism. How is Bush seen now in Europe in terms of being, you know, a unilateral kind of guy or an ally kind of guy?
He's still seen very much as a unilateral kind of guy. His, you know, President Clinton was ever emollient and seemed to get the tone right. I mean, though he, in many people's views, patronized the Europeans and in some sense, you know, lied, not lied in a sense of a falsehood, but, you know, when he signed the Kyoto Treaty on Environmental Protection, he knew it wasn't going to get passed, but he signed it anyway. Bush never played long. He simply said, we can't get this passed, so forget it. It's just partly it's a difference in tone, but there is a feeling that September 11th was an interim period, and yet in a way was a kind of accelerant of a lot of trends, underlying trends, and that as the war in Afghanistan has gone on, allies have been helpful allies and eager allies. And, you know, as you know, French planes are flying in Afghanistan and there are German troops there and German peacekeepers and British troops. And, you know, allies are playing perhaps a more significant role than many Americans realize now in Afghanistan. However, on things like the International Criminal Court, which was a very big and recent and quite bitter fight, there is again a feeling among Europeans that the United States is pursuing its own interests no matter what the interests are of its allies. And though it is discussing many things with its allies, it's not really listening very carefully. And that, you know, it seems unwilling to sacrifice anything that Washington thinks is in its own interests for the larger interests of the Western world. And lastly, I suppose, people feel that Washington is underestimating the value of allies themselves.
In Europe, which leaders are President Bush's greatest supporters and greatest detractors?
It's a good question. I mean, in general, the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, though he's, you know, from the center-left, has been a very important help to President Bush. Not sure they really like each other very much, but Britain always tries to straddle the ocean and to be an interlocutor between other Europeans and the United States and vice versa. But that stretch is getting very difficult for him. And the International Criminal Court was a blow to the British and a blow to Mr. Blair. He was ridiculed at home for his efforts to find a compromise. And many people felt that the Bush people had repaid his loyalty to them rather shabbily. Mr. Bush also has great support among the conservative Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, among the conservative Spanish Prime Minister José María Aznar, and among others. You know, and the United States in general, you know, has a lot of support in Germany, from where I'm speaking to you.
My guest is Steve Erlanger, Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Steve Erlanger is my guest. He's the Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times. Let's talk a little bit about the impact of September 11th on Europe. You're based in Berlin, in Germany. Germany has been one of the important places in the investigation of Al-Qaeda because there have been Al-Qaeda cells there, and there have been terrorist base there who helped plan September 11th. Would you just kind of describe Germany's place as a location for Al-Qaeda planners?
Yes, Germany was absolutely central to September 11th. In Hamburg, beautiful port city to the north of here, where I've spent quite a lot of time, there was a cell of Arab students and immigrants to Germany who carried out September 11th attacks. I mean, they were considered the ringleaders and the planners, and they moved freely from Hamburg to America and back and all around Europe and sometimes to Asia too in pursuit of this rather amazing plot. So it's caused a lot of self-searching in Germany. After the Nazi period, the Germans, you know, with the help and advice of their American conquerors, put into place lots of very strong protections for the individual against the state and against state prying data protection laws. And the Germans now believe some of those laws were so strong that they protected some of the Al-Qaeda sleepers who were in Germany, that you know, had the state had more police powers and paid more attention to certain kinds of investigations, they might have uncovered this plot before it actually happened. Might have. But it's a big issue here.
There's a large Muslim population in many European countries. And I'm wondering if you're actually feeling tensions in communities, in the streets, in places where you've been in Germany and other parts of Europe since 9/11.
Without question, there is a great increase in tension and, you know, a great feeling that people in these communities have of being increasingly watched, not just by the police, but by their neighbors. Germany, as you probably know, has, you know, something like 3 million Turks who were brought to this country over the decades as guest workers, and many of whom settled here, many of whom now have German citizenship and raised families here. Turks are pretty secular, and there is a much smaller number of Arab immigrants and students, and it was from this population in general that Al-Qaeda converts came. But Germany is not, you know, the only issue here. The French have more Muslims than any other country in Europe, also more Jews. And, you know, partly it's French history. Many of these are Moroccan and North Africans. And in London, too, where there are quite a lot of immigrants from South Asia in particular, there have been some very interesting revelations about radical mosques in London and also in the north of England that seem to have been recruiting grounds for Al-Qaeda activists and jihad warriors, people who went to Bosnia or went to Chechnya. So the Europeans have woken up to a much bigger problem. You know, one could argue that their domestic intelligence services were looking at these places but weren't too worried because the targets of these people were not domestic. And after September 11th, that kind of, I think, sloppiness and selfishness has disappeared.
Do you think that Europe is dealing with immigration and security issues post 9/11 any differently as a result of the existence of the European Union than it would have been dealing with it just as individual countries?
It's a very interesting question, and I think that's true because sometimes, you know, the way American politicians like to blame Washington for things that they don't want to do or that just get imposed on them, they think. Europeans can use the European Union that way too. But the European Union is 15 nations who, in a sense, you know, most of whom allow freedom of travel. You know, once you're inside it, you can go anywhere, the so-called Schengen visas. The British keep apart from this, partly because of the Channel. But in general, you know, you can go all over Europe once you're inside without showing your passport to anybody. Now, that's a wonderful thing, but it's easier for terrorists to move. So there's a lot of concentration now on building up the borders of the EU to be, you know, more tuned toward serious challenges of immigration. And these are technical questions, but also there's an effort to cut illegal immigration as a separate political issue because there's been a kind of conservative backlash in Europe, which is not really to do with September 11th, in my view, but certainly has been accelerated by it. So the effort to cut down on illegal immigration has become a European Union issue. And at its last big summit meeting in Spain, I think last month, this was a big, big topic. And there were no real, you know, resolutions, quick ones. But as a union, countries are trying to make their immigration requirements more uniform, so immigrants can't pick and choose. They're trying to make their refugee status requirements more uniform, and they are trying to crack down on people smuggling.
Cracking down on immigration was one of the issues that Jean-Marie Le Pen championed. He is the extremist right-wing French leader who did very well in the first round of the presidential election last April. Was his success encouraging or spurring on other extremist leaders through Europe?
Yes, but I mean, in a way, he was himself a beneficiary of an earlier movement against immigration. This is, you know, Jörg Haider, who's the far-right leader in Austria, who's not in the government, but whose party is important to the government, ran very strongly, you know, on a campaign of keeping immigrants out. And you see in other countries of Europe, surprising countries, the Netherlands, Denmark, not just countries like France and Austria, serious backlash against uncontrolled immigration, which is itself a kind of euphemism for shutting the doors. And it has echoes in Germany, too, where there's a big campaign that will end September 22nd and the possibility of a whole new government. And one of the issues here also is, you know, immigration.
Steve Erlanger is Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Steve Erlanger. He writes about Europe for the New York Times. He's the Times' Berlin bureau chief and former bureau chief for Central Europe and the Balkans. I want to ask you a little bit about the euro and the European Union. Let's talk a little bit about the euro, and this might be of particular interest to any of our listeners who are planning to travel to Europe this summer. This week, for the first time, the euro became worth slightly more than the dollar. What's the importance of that?
Well, psychologically, it's very important because when the, you know, the euro, which is used as the currency in 12 of the 15 European Union members right now, makes traveling very convenient. You know, you don't have to change money when you go from country to country. But when it was first introduced in January of 99, not as physical bills at that point, but as a currency that had fixed value against all these other 12 currencies, it started life worth it was higher than the dollar. It was about worth the $1.18 for 1 euro. And it started to sink immediately. And it's been sinking for more than 2 years. It reached a low of like 82.5 cents in the fall of 2000. But as Europe has been complaining more about the Bush administration and this sort of superheated American, you know, reach and patriotism and unilateralism, the fact that the euro is now back above the dollar has made people smile some in satisfaction. Financially doesn't mean very much. Currencies go up and down. And it really is much more to do with a weak dollar than with a strong euro. The dollar is at its low against the Japanese yen, too, and against the British pound. But it will make vacations in Europe a bit more expensive for Americans, but it shouldn't have a terribly big impact yet on exports and imports. The big fear people have is simply that the combination of now this big American trade deficit and this big American budget deficit, together with the stock market crash and scandals about American corporate practices, means that confidence in the American economy is being undermined and that there will be a flight of capital from the United States. A lot of it will go into euros. That's fine. But people worry that it's going to bring down, you know, the economy even farther. Nobody wants the dollar to fall too far, in other words.
Well, what impact is the euro having on creating a European group identity?
It has an important impact, you know? I mean, it is a physical, real thing. It's Europe in your pocket. And it's like, you know, every country has its own passport. But now in Europe, at least among members of the European Union, they all look the same and they say European Union on them. But people don't use their passports every day and they use their money every day. And I think more and more, you know, people do feel they're not quite sure what being a European is. But you know, you do find more young people in particular who are traveling and working all over the continent with a kind of freedom their parents find extraordinary, and it's an extraordinary success. You know, you ask them and some of them will say, yes, I'm a European. So there is, you know, something being built here called Europe. I mean, no one can quite define it. As I say, the European Union is going through, as it's trying to enlarge, it's also trying to reform its rules to make them more efficient. And it's trying to write itself a new constitution that will govern, you know, weighted majorities and how things work. But it is becoming more real as an entity, and it's becoming more real to the people who live here, too.
Is shopping different with the euro than it used to be?
Well, it is, actually, particularly if you're going somewhere. I mean, you know, if you're at home, fine. A lot of people still get confused because they still think in their old currencies. It was easy for the Germans because basically 1 euro is 2 marks, you know, so that was simple. A lot harder for the French because, you know, 1 euro was something like 7 point something francs. But people are complaining a lot because prices have rounded up, you know, they think. And it's true, particularly on day-to-day goods like a cup of coffee or a roll at a bakery or a glass of wine or a bottle of beer. You know, people like nice round prices. So something, you know, that would have cost 2 marks before, you know, might cost 1 euro now, that would be a bargain. But in general, it's likely to cost 1.50 euro now. And people resent that. There's been a lot of talk about that. But certainly as a traveler, if you go anywhere inside the zone, it's wonderful. I mean, you don't have to change money at the airport. You just get into another taxi, use the same money. There's one nice little difference. The bills are all the same, and the coins are all the same on one side, but each country gets the right to, you know, put its own symbols on the other side of its coins. So that, you know, more and more in Europe, as the coins spread, you find yourself with a pocket full of coins that have, you know, that originated in France and Austria and Greece and Germany and Portugal, and people still like to find, you know, they talk about which ones are most attractive, you know. And I personally like the Portuguese 2 euro coin and the Italian 1 euro coin. But, you know, people collect them and kids collect them, and it sort of adds to this sense that, you know, this is one civilization. It has its differences, it has its problems, it's still fighting about lots of things. The nation state has not gone away. The French and the Germans are squabbling bitterly now over agriculture, for instance. But there is much more of a sense of an entity being born.
Well, let's get to the important stuff. I'm wondering, I don't know if you collect jokes or not, but I'm wondering if there's any good America jokes that have been circulating, or jokes about the American stock market, jokes about politics in America, jokes about the hunt for terrorists. Tell me.
I always feel sort of odd, put on the spot. I mean, I can tell you lots of jokes, but about current politics and America... harder. The funny thing that I saw recently, I don't know if it's true, but there's a great story going around, you know, there's this impression that George Bush isn't very smart, and that he actually was saying to another European leader about the French, he said, you know, the French don't even have a word for entrepreneur. That's a vignette.
Oh, I get it.
It's rather the way Ronald Reagan used to say, you know, the Russians don't have a word for peace. But of course, the Russians did have a word for peace, you know, mir. So, you know, you just never know. A lot of people, I must say, don't find the Bush administration a joking matter.
Steve Erlanger, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Steve Erlanger is Berlin Bureau Chief for the New York Times. This is Fresh Air.